Welcome to the Times of Israel's daily briefing. Today is Wednesday, April 10th, day 187 of the war with Hamas. Amanda Borchel Dan here with our editor, David Horowitz, and military reporter, Emmanuel Fabian. Hello to you both.
Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Amanda.
U.S. President Joe Biden has urged the Israelis to just call for a 6 to 8 week ceasefire. David will weigh in. Manny is here and will update us on what's happening on the ground in Gaza since the drawdown of troops early this week, as well as new threats from Iran. All this and much, much more when we're back.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
David, Israel is seen as increasingly heeding the demands made by U.S. President Joe Biden in a telephone conversation with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu late last week, including massive increases in humanitarian aid to almost really pre-war levels. So when we hear Biden say in a Spanish television interview that he did make prior to the conversation with Netanyahu last week, but Biden said that he's urging the Israelis to call for a 6 to 8 week ceasefire. Is this something that at this point we should just expect?
I think we should expect it and hear what the American president, on whom we rely for diplomatic support, which has not always been complete, and weapon supplies to be able to fight this war, which many maybe can tell us more about what's going on with that. It's very significant. I think the timing is significant as well. This was, as you say, 2 days after the Israeli airstrike that killed seven workers from the World Central Kitchen NGO, with whom Israel was working. Obviously, a very angry American president who's been very critical of the whole Israeli approach to humanitarian aid into Gaza. And I think we should also bear in mind that it was indeed almost a week ago, and something has changed in the Israeli response. I suspect that Biden would phrase things a little differently were he speaking today. I'm sure we'll see in the future. And we do know that, for example, yesterday, two of his most senior officials, Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken, National Security Advisor, Secretary of State, did speak in very different terms and spoke about that there has been a change, and there apparently indeed has been a change in terms of Israeli policy seeking to maximize aid going into Gaza. But at the root of the Biden comments, of course, is something else that he said, which is that he thinks Netanyahu has been mishandling the war, and that's not going to change. And it evidently took really a very, very, very angry interaction between Biden and Netanyahu for Netanyahu to change the policy on aid.
David, it appears that Biden really believes that all of the onus is on Israel in terms of the pace of this war and in terms of any kind of ceasefire agreement. Do you think that that's a fair assessment?
It seems to be much of the thrust of his thinking, and it seems hard to reconcile with reality, shall we say? I mean, on the one hand, you have an American president saying, "Hey, stop the fighting," and now in some recent comments, including that one, not in the non-veto at the UN, not conditioning that on Hamas doing anything. And we know Hamas won't do anything. So, for example, if Israel were to halt the war completely, which it's not far off doing, by the way, and I'm sure you and Manny will discuss that, why would Hamas do anything other than rejoice, in fact, continue to rejoice that it is surviving the Israeli response to its massacres in Israel on October the 7th? Why would it release hostages? It's had the two pressure points relieved. There is no heavy, intensive Israeli military pressure. and there is no humanitarian leverage being used against it, if that was the case hitherto. It's not being targeted in Rafah, and therefore the American response seems miscalibrated, misdirected. America says that it wants Israel to be able to defeat Hamas. It recognizes that Hamas will rearm and rebuild and do this all over again if it can, and yet it is increasingly diplomatically and in terms of the narrative publicly, and for all I know, practically, making it very difficult for Israel to continue to wage effective warfare against Hamas.
Now, the one possible lever that Israel holds is a potential military option in Rafah. And this week, Netanyahu said that he has circled a date on his calendar for the Rafah operation. But Defense Minister Yoav Gallant told his U.S. counterpart Lloyd Austin during a call on Monday that Israel indeed has not set a date. So is this some kind of matter of need-to-know information, David?
I think it reflects immense amounts of bravado, bombast, misinformation, inaccurate comments. I mean, we're this whole discussion is about the things that people are saying that don't quite make sense. So, and in many cases that people don't believe. Netanyahu telling the world that he's circled the date for the Rafah operation. Yeah, that's great. Netanyahu telling the world that we are a step away from victory over Hamas. These are empty statements. Israel is not a step away from destroying Hamas. A quarter of Hamas is still standing, and its leadership is still standing, and it's still holding the hostages. There's another comment that we highlighted that was walked back by Gallant a couple of days ago, in which he said Hamas is no longer functioning as a military organization in Gaza. And several hours later, when it was picked up upon, he'd also contradicted himself in the following sentences by stressing, of course, that Hamas has battalions in Rafah and so on. He walked it back and said, no, I just meant the areas where the army has been operating. But the army is no longer really operating in Gaza in any kind of intensive way. So there's immense amounts of rhetoric and a major distance between some of that rhetoric and reality. And while we focus on this, Hamas is, you know, I don't want to say sitting pretty, and I don't think we should go to the other extreme. Three quarters of Hamas as an organized, as an army, has been destroyed by the IDF. But the final quarter has not, and the final quarter is deployed in a city where the leadership probably is, on the Egyptian border through which Hamas armed itself in years past. And therefore, the distance, if you like, between what is said and what is happening, and by the way, and what America is saying and what it is telling Israel to do, it's saying, yes, we want you to be able to destroy Hamas. We want you to destroy Hamas. You have the right, the obligation to destroy Hamas, because otherwise it's going to do it again. But we really don't think you should be going to Rafah because we don't believe you can do it safely. And we want you actually to have a ceasefire now, which takes all the pressure off Hamas.
A couple more statements that may or may not make sense. Marking Eid al-Fitr, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken highlighted the plight of Palestinians in the West Bank, along Muslim suffering in some of the world's worst conflicts. And last week, United States Senator Elizabeth Warren told a Boston mosque that Israel will be found guilty of genocide in the International Court of Justice. Of course, her office later clarified her comments. But how prevalent do you see this thinking of Israel as the oppressor among the Democrat upper echelons at this point?
Look, there's an incredible problem in the way Israel is being perceived and in the way it is being represented and the way this conflict is being represented and understood. And it has been the case from the start. And some of this is just way off the mark. And some of this is entangled with the vast antipathy to the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, who, of course, was in charge in the years going up to October the 7th and insistently remains in charge since. And this is all getting mixed up into one unholy assault on essentially on Israel's legitimacy and right and capacity to defend itself against organizations coordinated by Iran in Gaza in the shape of Hamas, in the West Bank, where Hamas is also being supplied with weaponry, where there are also other extreme groups and other terror groups on the northern border with Hezbollah, all of which are seeking and overtly seeking to tear Israel apart, to destroy this country. So it's an incredibly problematic reality that we are in. Elizabeth Warren clarified that she meant that the court in the, because we're talking about the interim measures, it almost doesn't matter. I mean, in fact, it really doesn't matter the informed, nuanced interpretation of some kind of drastic and dramatic comment. The same applies with Biden. Yeah, he didn't really mean that. He said it a week ago. This is not a change of policy. She didn't really mean that. David Cameron didn't really mean everything that he said about the urgent need for a ceasefire, but it has to be sustainable. The thrust of the comments, the impression that is being given, is creating this sense of illegitimacy about Israel's need to destroy the organization in Gaza that would otherwise want to wipe out this country and made a very, very serious invasion of the country and killed 1,200 people and so on, and the other efforts on other borders coordinated by Iran and others to do the same.
We'll go to a short break.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. As David mentioned, the IDF has experienced a big drawdown from the Gaza Strip. But this morning, the IDF mentioned that the Nahal Brigade soldiers are still battling Hamas gunmen in the central Gaza corridor. Is this the only location where battles are still being fought, Manny?
It isn't the only location, but it is the only location where troops are sort of semi-permanently deployed. So they're operating in the Netzarim corridor, which is the route we've talked about that splits Gaza from the Be'eri area to the coast. It allows the army to operate in northern and central Gaza, and as well as enable humanitarian aid to be delivered directly to northern Gaza. So there are battles taking place within the area of the corridor and sort of nearby areas. There was a recent operation as well by troops, sort of a targeted operation where they went in and out in the Shajaiya area. There was another one in Deir al-Balah as well, sort of near Deir al-Balah. But the primary area where troops are deployed to is on this corridor itself. Like we've mentioned, Khan Yunis, where an entire division was, that the all of those troops were withdrawn from Gaza. And the IDF's explanation for that is, one, because the operations there have essentially wrapped up. There is they've completed all their goals there. They have nothing really left to do. Also, because the division, the 98th division, had been fighting there for 4 straight months, they need time to rest. And the last reason is the army has said that the troops need to prepare themselves for future operations now, and that also includes Rafah. It is unlikely that only one division would be used for an operation in Rafah. When we saw the initial offensive in northern Gaza, that involved 4 or 5 divisions at the height of it. So, like we said about Netanyahu circling a date, I don't think a date really matters, because when the army starts preparing for this offensive, we'll likely know about it. There'll be a call up of troops. There'll be work to move the population out of Rafah. It's not going to be a surprise. We'll have a few weeks warning before this operation happens. So circling an exact date isn't all that important at this point.
Manny, how much freedom of movement do Gazans have at this point throughout the Strip?
So Palestinians can move around in southern Gaza and in northern Gaza. They can also move from north to the south, but not the other way around. So the army is at this corridor is preventing Palestinians from moving back from southern Gaza to northern Gaza. But since the withdrawal from Khan Yunis, Palestinians are able to move from Rafah to Khan Yunis after the army finished up there, although many of the buildings there are damaged and destroyed. But doing so, by leaving the Khan Yunis area, this actually will sort of begin the initial evacuation of Rafah, where some people will be returning to the Khan Yunis area, and that will make it a bit easier to move the rest of the people later on.
We're hearing reports of unprecedented numbers of humanitarian aid trucks going into the Strip and even to the northern part of Gaza, as well as, 40,000 tents that have been ordered up to house the relocated residents of Rafah. What else are you hearing?
So on yesterday, the amount of trucks that entered Gaza was 468. That was a record high since the beginning of the war. Topping the previous day of 419, that means over the past 3 days, around 1,200 trucks have been inspected by Israeli authorities and have entered Gaza. It is close to the pre-war numbers, but it's important to note that before the war, it wasn't just aid trucks entering, it was also carrying building supplies and other equipment that wasn't necessarily food and medical aid, which is the only thing that's entering Gaza right now. Also, there have been record numbers of airdrops of food. And like you mentioned, some of these trucks have also gone directly into northern Gaza. I believe it was 47 trucks yesterday that went directly to northern Gaza.
Let's turn to a statement made this morning by Iran's supreme leader, who said that Tehran will retaliate for Israel's alleged bombing of a building in Damascus earlier this month. So among the threats that Israel is taking really seriously are cyber attacks, which cyber defense chief Gabi Portnoy spoke about yesterday. What did he say, Manny?
He said that in the first 3 months of following the October 7th attack, there was a sort of almost a triple the number of cyber attacks on Israel. I think he said 3,380 incidents during that period. There's been attacks by Iran and Iran-linked groups on some of them also linked to Hezbollah, on Israeli medical centers and public infrastructure. And that has been a pretty serious threat amid the war. But as we've talked about before, that Iran's the sort of the main thing Israel is preparing for is a potential missile or drone attack from Iran or from its proxies on Israel, rather than some sort of significant cyber attack. Although it could be that as well, we could see a mix of several attacks.
So let's talk about drones, and we've discussed their use quite a bit over the past 6 months in Jenin, in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip. And lately, in the past several days, we saw two events that pricked my antenna. And in the first, an Israeli drone that was downed by Hezbollah over southern Lebanon was later exploded by the Air Force. Why would the Air Force do this?
This isn't actually the first time this has happened. There was another drone that was downed by Hezbollah a couple months ago. Similar circumstances. It was a different drone model in that case. But in both cases, the drone was shot down by Hezbollah's air defenses. And then once the IDF is able to locate the wreckage, they targeted it. The previous time, they were able to strike the remains of the drone within just a few hours. This case, it took a few days to find the exact site. The reason why they do this is that to prevent the remains from falling into Hezbollah hands. Even after the drone is knocked down, there are still some remains that Hezbollah could take control of, attempt to reverse engineer it, extract intelligence from it, or other important information that would basically aid it. So the army, the Air Force specifically struck the remains of the drone to destroy it and prevent any sensitive information from falling into Hezbollah's hands. I'll just note that the drone that was shot down a few weeks ago was a Hermes 450 drone, and this, the one that was shot down on Saturday, was a Hermes 900, which is a more advanced model. That is, I think, the first and only ever drone of that model to have been shot down. It only entered service about a decade ago.
So the second case that pricked my antenna was a ship-mounted version of the Iron Dome missile defense system that intercepted a drone that entered Israeli airspace near Eilat shortly before midnight, actually, on Monday. And the military shot it down from the Iron Dome on a boat, if I'm not mistaken. And that was the first time that that happened. What happened here?
Right. So the system, which is known as Sea Dome, it is a iron dome, basically, but it is deployed to the Navy's SAR 6 class corvettes. One of these corvettes has been deployed to the Red Sea, to the Eilat area, to counter the recent Houthi attacks. Although this drone actually came from the Iraq direction. It was launched by an Iran-backed group there. So the Sea Dome system was declared operational in late 2022. It had not seen any use. It only had gone through some tests. And for the first time, it was used and successfully intercepted this drone that entered Israeli airspace. It was heading toward Eilat. We've seen previously a drone launch from Iraq that hit the Navy's hangar in Eilat. So in this case, they were actually able to down it. And it is a pretty historic moment for the Navy to be able to successfully intercept a target with this new system. It's a much more advanced model of the Iron Dome because it is moving at all times. It's on a ship. So it's not like the static Iron Dome battery, which basically stays in one place and then moves and then is deployed to another area. So it's a bit more of a bit more complicated operation. And it is the Navy that is conducting the interception rather than the Air Force, which normally operates the Iron Dome batteries.
So speaking of a complicated conception, when we say drone, I kind of imagine these like small things with cameras that my neighbors fly and they sound like bees and they're very annoying. But I guess that what we're seeing come from Iraq, from with the capability to come from Iran, is something much different than this. What are we talking about? Give us a little bit of scale here.
So the drones that we've seen, both the drones and the cruise missiles that we've seen launched from both Yemen and Iraq are pretty big, about the size of a small car. Some of the models that Iran has that it supplies to its proxies are a bit bigger, some a bit smaller, but they're not very small. And they do carry a relatively large payload of explosives, not huge, because most of the weight on these drones is for it to fly far enough. The fuel for it to reach distant areas all the way to Israel. When they launch these drones, it's not a short journey. It takes several hours for it to reach from Yemen or from Iraq to Israel. It's several hundred kilometers or even more than 1,000 kilometers if it's coming from Yemen. It's really not a short trip. So there's an advantage to Israel with this where if it can detect it early, it's able to intercept it. The problem is they're very usually they fly quite low. They're not always detected by radars. They fly slowly as well. They're not a fast moving object, which stands out. But there are ways of detecting them. And once they do, they're able to intercept it. In this case, it was detected shortly before entering Israeli airspace. Once it had entered, it was tracked and then intercepted by the Sea Dome system. But there have been other cases where Israel's been unable to detect it early enough, like we saw with the strike on the Navy hangar. There was also a drone that hit a school in Eilat last year. There's been a few cases where the air defenses have been unable to detect it quick enough.
So just to clarify, when you say it doesn't have a very heavy payload, what kind of destruction could be wrought if we were to see a potential drone attack from Iran?
I think I'll point listeners to take a look at the story on the drone that hit the hangar in Eilat. And you can see that it damaged part of the hangar. It broke some of the metal sheeting, but not too much damage. And same with the school in Eilat. Part of the building was damaged, but not the whole building was destroyed. So we're talking about a payload that can cause significant damage depending on what it strikes. If it strikes a building, it will break a wall or two. It won't demolish an entire building. But there are, you know, they're used in a more strategic way. If they are going to try and target a sensitive asset, they would likely use a drone. If they're trying to cause heavy destruction, then Iran would use something larger, like a ballistics missile, which carries a much larger payload and has to fly into space and then back down again. That's really the sort of the difference here with what they're going to use, and depending on what they're trying to target.
Manny, David, thank you so much for your updates and insights today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Please check out another installment tomorrow. This episode was produced by The Podwaves. If you have any questions or comments, please drop us an email to podcast@timesofisrael.com. Until tomorrow, shalom.